Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
Like the nut behind the wheel, the insider threat has emerged as the most persistent challenge in cybersecurity. No matter, the Defense Department is moving ahead with new rules for defense contractors aimed at limiting damage from insiders with security clearance. Joining me with details, Jim Harris, senior counsel at the law firm Holland & Knight. Jim, good to have you on.
Well, hi, Tom.
So tell us what they're doing here. It looks like, as you put it, government is turning increasingly to private enterprise to support counterintelligence. What's going on?
Well, the rule, the security rule, is called the NISPOM, the National Industrial Security Program Operating Manual. And traditionally, this is focused on security rules. And that has been amended on May 18th to require a formal insider threat program at every cleared contractor.
And so that's quite a number of contractors affected then by this.
Yes. So it's in excess of 10,000 companies, and there are about 13,000 facility clearances.
And this would include both small business and all the way up to the big major aerospace contractors?
Yes.
Now, would some of the large companies already have these types of programs in place to begin with?
Well, they probably do, but it would not have been required. They did. They were offering the Defense Security Service, for example, who oversees most of the clearances. They were offering an enhancement to their security vulnerability assessments for such a program, but now it's becoming a baseline standard across the whole program.
So DOD is requiring companies to establish an insider threat program. What are the elements of an insider threat program that companies will have to install?
Well, at a high level, they're going to need to be able to gather, integrate, and report information that indicates a potential or actual insider threat. Part of this will include designating a senior official to be in charge of the program. They identify this person as the insider threat program senior official, but maybe another way to look at this person would be the facility's counterintelligence officer, similar to what they already have, which is a facility security officer. They will also need to be able to self-assess their program, and this will include management involvement in the execution and remedy of what they find in the assessments.
So this insider threat senior official that they have to designate, you said this person might already be there in another role, or will they have to hire someone, and therefore there's a cost associated with compliance here?
The DSS, or Defense Security Service, is allowing them to use an existing person. So they don't have to go out and hire an additional person.
And then also they're asked to self-assess their insider threat programs. That seems to let DOD itself off the hook.
Well, they will definitely have to self-assess. So in some sense, you're right that they're transferring some responsibility over to the company.
And what does that mean in terms of something happening? Suppose an insider threat outbreak occurs or someone steals information or government data. What is the sanction if the company has self-professed to be able to handle these things?
Well, I think that it's a good question, but it maybe reveals more about the approach that they're taking is maybe not the traditional regulatory type of approach with where they have rules and sanctions. This is really something different. They are definitely looking towards the goal, which is national security and the delivery that's uncompromised of goods and services. So they're hoping to get early detection of these threats and try to prevent something bad from happening.
We're speaking with Jim Harris, senior counsel at Holland & Knight. And there is also the requirement for companies to monitor computer network activity. So that's a tangible thing.
Yes.
And would the DOD have access to the logs or the results of that monitoring?
Well, they will definitely follow up and want to inspect the records of what is produced by the program. Now, the level of detail that they will get into, that's again something that is going to play out over the next couple of years. We'll figure out how much information is actually going to be reported.
And what is the timeline for all of this to be in place under the new NISPOM?
Well, there's a standard provision in the NISPOM that any changes has a six-month grace period. And the DSS has said that that's November 30th would be a time where they're going to want to have every company to at least have a written program in place.
I guess the question then becomes for a company, how much do they disclose to the government and how much do they consider, what can they consider? Well, that's our business, not the government's business, especially, again, in light of something that might happen down the line.
That's true. Yeah, that's something that's definitely going to be worked out, and it may have some variation between the different types of companies, what the specific activities they're working on, you know, might require. So there are going to be a lot of discussions between companies and the government going forward.
At this point, though, has DOD issued detailed guidelines at all on what types of information or typical types of information they would expect to be disclosed by companies?
Well, DSS has done a pretty good job of posting on their internet site, dss.mil, guidance. One of the things that they talk about are the 13 personnel security adjudicative guidelines. And, you know, those are the things that you can find at Title 32, Part 147.
All right, we'll have to look that one up. So, and also, each company doesn't have equal degrees of national security implication. If you're building electronics for a fighter plane, that's one thing. If you may have clearance and you're delivering food, say, to the Pentagon or to, you know, the armed services, that's a different level of security. So can the response and the programs companies set up vary according to how much of a security risk they really are?
I think that you'll see a good bit of variance. There'll be a basic baseline minimum standards, but I think there'll be several follow-on conversations with DSS about proportionality and what are we trying to protect and what are the real vulnerabilities and threats at your specific location.
So what are the top three things a company should do right now to make sure that they comply within 6 months with this new directive?
Well, I would refer them to the DSS website and take advantage of the resources there, at least setting up the minimum program. There's some training that's going to be involved, particularly for all the cleared folks. They're going to get training that appears to be focused on identifying threats. And then the program folks will get a lot of other training that includes legal and privacy, civil liberties type of training, in addition to more advanced counterintelligence training. Another thing they want to think about are maybe less the consequences with DSS, but maybe the side effects that you could possibly anticipate. As you mentioned before, costs. Some of those costs may be recoverable under their government contracts. They'd want to check that out. And also just the maybe some of the obvious human resources and employment law type of issues that you can anticipate arising as a result of this.
Jim Harris is senior counsel for the law firm Holland & Knight. Thanks so much for joining me.
Well, thank you, Tom.
You can read more and share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages. Listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The government issues something like 1 million contract actions every year, and only a few are protested, about 2,500. But bid and award protests have a lot of impact and cost. Both the House and Senate are proposing protest reform in their versions of the 2017 National Defense Authorization Act. Helpful or doing more harm than good? For analysis, we turn to Stuart Turner, senior counsel at the law firm Arnold & Porter. Mr. Turner, great to have you on.
Thank you very much.
All right, so first of all, Does this need reform in the opinion of a lawyer who handles bid protests for companies?
Well, I certainly think that most people in the industry would agree that the study provisions that both the House and Senate are calling for would be a valuable addition to the landscape. Both the House and Senate are requesting an analysis of the frequency of protests, the cost of protests, the effectiveness of protests, the timelines that protests tend to carry, and I think that that is a valuable exercise. The specific provisions that are set forth largely in the Senate bill, I think, really need to get looked at in terms of their longer-term impact. While they clearly are identifying what could be a significant policy interest, I think that industry is somewhat cautious before embracing the full extent of these Senate revisions.
The Senate would impose loser's costs on the protester, kind of the English system of law here. And that seems really radical, because protesters do have the legal right to protest government actions.
Well, there are numerous fee-shifting provisions in the law that aren't necessarily seen as radical, but it would be a big change for the protest environment, certainly. I think the strongest medicine that's being prescribed by the Senate committee is for incumbent contractors who protest. Specifically, the provision says that any large businesses that file a protest that doesn't result in a GAO decision sustaining the protest would have to pay GAO the costs, as you mentioned, the English rule. But there's another provision specifically directed at incumbent protesters incumbent contractors who protest. So an incumbent contractor who protests and is awarded a bridge contract, what's called a bridge contract, an interim contract intended to deliver services to the government during the pendency of a protest or during any other procurement delay, all profit and fee on a contract like that would be withheld by the government during the pendency of any protest filed by that incumbent bridge contract holder. And then if GAO does not issue a decision sustaining the protest, but the contract is eventually awarded to another company, that other company would receive all of the withheld profit and fee from the bridge contract, which is clearly a very strong piece of medicine to give profit that one company has ostensibly earned on a contract to its competitor.
I guess the idea is to eliminate what they call serial protesters, and also those people that get the extension of the contract while the protest is winding its way through GAO and possibly the courts. That could be a year in some cases.
There's nothing improper or illegal about bridge contracts in any way. Perfectly legitimate means by which the government can take care of gaps in services or gaps in supply that it needs. And there are any number of reasons why they may be needed. I mean, the agency itself faces lots of obstacles in the procurement calendar, and they can't always get a contract awarded when they want to, which means that certain things like protests would take the procurement calendar out past the expiration of the prior contract, and bridge contracts are a tool to do that.
Yeah, that happens a lot in telecommunications contracts over the years.
To be sure, and it happens a lot in the defense space. I think the difference between the House and the Senate is both the House and the Senate are calling for research, this independent entity to be appointed to do research on the protest process and to specifically examine incumbent protests and bridge contracts and come up with some real data about how frequent that is and what the impacts of that are. But I think the difference is that the Senate is comfortable enough that there is such a thing as a, quote, serial protester, as a Senate aide put it when speaking to the press about these provisions, that would file protests for the sole reason of obtaining bridge contracts. And I think that's a pretty strong finding for the Senate to make while simultaneously requesting research on the extent of that problem. So they seem to be simultaneously calling for a study of the extent and severity of the problem while also prescribing very strong medicine to fix it. That is a bit of a tension in the Senate approach, but that's possibly one of the purposes of it, is to send a strong signal that this, whatever form this reform ends up taking, that lawmakers are very interested in it, and they are not afraid to take a strong stand that they believe this problem exists.
We're speaking with Stuart Turner, senior counsel at the law firm Arnold and Porter. And what about the provision that would take away the GAO's province over protests of task orders under government-wide acquisition contracts? What is the distinction, do you feel, between those and a contract awarded in open market?
Well, this is the next chapter in a story that's been unfolding over the past 5 or 6 years. The issuance of a task order under a broader contract represents a contracting innovation that was originally instituted to create efficiency within the procurement system. So an agency could award an overall contract vehicle and then have that be specifically competed and then issue task orders with less formality, with a more streamlined process. And several years ago, Congress took the step of granting GAO, which had not had this jurisdiction before, specifically granting GAO the right to hear protests of task order contracts of over $10 million. And there's some other filigrees around it, but that was primarily the grant. And there were two jurisdictional grants, one for the civilian agencies, one for the defense agencies. And they were intended to sunset initially in 2010. Congress took action to remove the sunset provision and make the jurisdiction permanent regarding the civilian agencies. And now we have an interesting split between the House and Senate, which is that the House bill contains provisions to remove the sunset provision on the grant of jurisdiction over defense task and delivery order contracts. In other words, the House wants to make that jurisdiction permanent and permanently grant it to the GAO. The Senate wants to do essentially the opposite, which is to say that for defense contracts, if the Secretary of Defense has appointed an ombudsman for task and delivery orders, which the Department of Defense does have, and establishes a specific provision for hearing complaints about such contracts, then the GAO would have no jurisdiction over task and order delivery contracts, essentially removing jurisdiction over those from GAO over those awards. And GAO has said that the expansion of their jurisdiction into the task and delivery order space has added several hundred protests a year to their docket. Not an overwhelming number, but certainly a notable increase. And we, you know, as practitioners, we've been seeing them as well. So the dialing down of that seems to be addressed not at any particular policy measure like these quote-unquote serial protester provisions or these incumbent provisions are, but more at just turning down the level of protest activity generally.
Because if the motivation is to maintain the popularity of GWACs, you would think that the protests of task orders really in the grand scheme of things is almost like the pea under the mattress. I mean, do you think the Senate is just simply making too much of something that in the grand scheme of things is really not that big an issue?
Well, it's tough for me to opine about the many reasons why the Senate may be taking that action. I mean, you know, the role of this may emanate from a desire to empower Defense Department ombudsman offices, which have been a political football and not specified in terms of their authority within DOD for a long time. I mean, this could derive from that. And the utility of those government-wide vehicles is the subject of another longer debate, which could play into a number of things that don't necessarily connect to the protest issues specifically. So it's tough to say whether it's well-directed or not. It's clearly one aspect of it is designed to simply reduce the number of protests of Defense Department contracts generally, and that's consistent with the foci of the two research proposals, both of which are asking this independent entity to go and find out how much protests are costing DOD, you know, whether they're effective, et cetera, which speaks to a desire to make general conclusions about the efficacy of bid protests overall.
And do you hear from your clients? What is their thought about what's happening or what could potentially happen with these bills?
Well, I think it's wait and see. As I mentioned, you know, these protest reform and general procurement reform issues get foregrounded during the debates, but the bill itself may not manifest the strongest versions of these reforms. Clearly, everybody has their antenna up because, you know, it's unlikely that Congress is going to ignore this issue regardless of the form of the final bill, so it's on people's minds. I think that insofar as some of the cost provisions are specifically targeted at large contractors, large contractors are looking at these and trying to get a sense of what these costs would entail, exactly how much they really move the needle in terms of thinking about protesting. And generally, every contractor lives on both sides of this divide. You know, I mean, they are in some cases incumbents, and in some cases they want to be new entrants and they want to be new awardees. So it's difficult to say that the government contracting community writ large sees these things as particularly aggressive at them. So they are more wait and see. They want to get a sense of what the landscape looks like and then adapts to it. But considering that these are more these are process issues that would affect them differently depending on their situation, I don't know that there's a general take for or against the restrictions.
Stuart Turner is senior counsel at the law firm Arnold & Porter. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks very much.
Read more and share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.